kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education Tide, a podcast about education, technology and everything in between with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Hello, Doug. How are you doing?
Am I right now that we've sorted out our microphone woes?
Been a problem, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. So I'm down in Brighton in a hotel room, just arrived, 5.5 hours on the train. And you are in your house in front of a new technology purchase, which we'll talk about in a moment. But we're both on Linux machines. And I think one of the things that we both, I guess, took for granted when we used Macs was that, especially with sound, everything just works, isn't it?
Well, it's a bit odd because we've been using, like the last two or three or four episodes, we've been using the Linux machines and they're fine. And the quality last week I thought was really good, more or less.
There was Although you said there was a little bit of an echo.
Yeah, you heard an echo, didn't you, when you were listening to it, which I didn't hear. Or maybe I was just so engrossed in what we were saying that I didn't pay attention.
Well, I always listen back to our episodes, you see, narcissistic as I am. Mainly because it's different, isn't it, participating in conversation versus listening to it. Notice listening to it on the way down that there was a bit of an echo. But we'll try and get sorted out, and it shouldn't be too bad. I'll try and do some post-production shenanigans, and we'll get there.
Yes, I've reverted to my MacBook to stop the echo that was coming out of the speakers in case it affected the audio. Here we go.
It's funny, isn't it, when you're on the road and you're away from your normal setup. And talking about normal setups, your normal setup's just changed, hasn't it, Di?
Yes, I've done this sort of crazy thing. So I've got my new Linux machine, which I'm very happy with, which is a Silent mini PC. And the one I bought before the summer, did I talk about this last week? I told you. I don't know if I told Tired.
The new machine? I don't think you did, no.
So I returned the one that I got because it had fans in it that were making noise, and that was very annoying. So I returned this product to Hong Kong, to China, sorry, and then got another one, which was Silent, which is good, which was actually cheaper in the end, the way it worked out. And so that was all fine. So that turned up in the summer at some point. And so I needed to get a monitor for it. So I was just going to buy another 28-inch HD monitor, like the one I had that the school had provided for me. But you mentioned you had a 4K monitor last week and that it was...
And you got monitor envy.
And I got a little bit... I thought, well, is 4K really that much better? Oh, my word. And I thought... So one of the things I've been noticing recently is that my eyesight is failing in more ways than one. So I've worn glasses for 30 years, but now I can't read stuff up close. So I need reading glasses. So I'm going to have to go into the varifocal world, which is
interesting.
It's a bit scary, really. I don't like it much. And so I thought the 4K thing sounded very sensible. So I thought, okay. And you said it wasn't too expensive what you'd spent on it. So I thought... So I went to have a look, and then I found these ultra wide monitors which look really amazing. I thought these look fantastic. And
so hang on, these aren't like 16:9 or 16:10. These are like what?
21:9. So that's sort of quite interesting, and they sort of split screen really well. So you kind of have two tiles or three tiles across the width of your screen. But then I kept on looking at what people were saying about these things, and they're 34-inch monitors, the ultra wide ones. The bigger ones, and you get them in different qualities, and you have to get the right one.
So just to put this in perspective, you know, lots of people have 42-inch televisions. The biggest iMac is what, 27 inches?
That's right, yeah. So I started looking at it and thinking, okay, this ultra-wide thing seems to be just the answer, you know, one monitor rather than having two. It's much simpler and straightforward. So looking into it further, I realized some people were talking about using 39-inch monitors, 4K monitors, because there's no 4K at ultra-wide. So I thought, if the 4K thing really is so good, and it was a balance, there's loads of videos on YouTube looking at the difference between ultra-wide or 4K, which one should I go for? And I'm like, okay, which one should I go for then? And all of these people just basically weigh up the odds, and for productivity, there were strengths to both of them, so the screen real estate sort of thing, and versus the quality of the pixels, the number of pixels, whatever, and density or whatever. And And then there was this one thing where I said, have the best of both worlds and go for a 39-inch 4K monitor. So I started, I thought, okay. So I looked, watched some people looking at this and how they used them. And they're obviously fantastic, as are the ultra wide for things like video editing, and because you have a really long timeline across the width of the screen, and that kind of thing. I thought, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And then
that would be amazing, wouldn't it? Doing time like iMovie or whatever on a massive timeline.
Exactly. And if you get into more complicated video editing software, which is the sort of thing that we're looking at doing using here, it's even more beneficial because your timeline's more detailed, etc. Or doing music editing, which I do as well, is a similar affair. So So then I looked at the best products of 39-inch monitors, because there's a sweet spot of some pixel density which you get on 4K and 27 inches or something, something like that. And then the sweet spot on the ultra wide is there as well. So I at 39 inches on the ultra wide, but on a normal 16,
yeah, there's, I mean, I have read stuff, you know, when people say, oh, yeah, I've got a 4K 32-inch TV. You think, well, your eye, at the distance you would be for a television, your eye can't actually resolve, even 20/20 vision, you can't resolve the difference between a 1080p monitor and a 4K TV. But when you get up close, like I've got a 4K screen on my laptop, and I'm obviously a lot closer than I would be on a TV. So yeah, you're right, the pixel density makes a huge difference.
Mm. And so, I mean, my TV isn't posh. I paid 100 quid for it secondhand. It's just 1080p, 42-inch television. And that was a few years ago. And anyway, so the product I eventually went with was an Acer 43-inch 4K computer monitor rather than television.
43 inches.
It seems huge, but it doesn't look anywhere near as huge. The bezels are really thin. Doesn't look as huge on my desk, and so it's just on my standing desk, and it's really, really good. You just have multiple windows open all the way around, and you can just glance between one thing or another. There is, I mean, it does look like if you move from one, your head from one side of the screen to the other, you are kind of feel like you're going to a different town, but kind of thing.
Well, that's the thing, silly, and but I think there's been lots of studies done on developers and productivity and things, and the thing you can do to increase a developer's productivity is give them a second screen. But I noticed, you know, back when I had an iMac, so now I connect my Dell laptop to my new Dell monitor, so with two screens. But back when I had a big iMac, I found that I used it differently. I used to tile things a bit more. Is that what you're doing? Like spaces?
Yeah, I just have lots of things open all of the time. So I haven't delved into the idea of making this software actually tile windows within the screen, if you see what I mean, the operating system. But I'm going to have a look at that. So you actually cut it into four sections or something and have, you know, like different desktops, workspaces in each one.
Like snap them to different areas, yeah.
Yeah, but at the moment I'm just dealing with windows in which I splice up myself to my own size, and then if I've got something that I want to concentrate on, I just full screen it, and it's just big and beautiful. Spreadsheets are taken a whole different
way. I can imagine, yeah.
And because it's 4K, you don't have to increase the size of everything to see it. And so I stand about 3 feet away from the monitor, I'd say. And it's lovely so far. I mean, I'm telling sunshine stories because I've just spent 500 quid on it. But
so you've changed every part of your setup basically this year, haven't you? You've changed it to a standing desk.
Yes,
got a 43-inch monitor and you've got a Linux box.
That's true. Although I'm wondering about going back to Windows is a very serious consideration, and that's just in deliberation at the moment. And the reason for that more than anything else is because that's what we use across the school. But I like having Linux in my life. So far it's been a good thing.
Well, I've just put in the show notes, I upgraded from Ubuntu 16.04 to 17.04. Now, every time I update Ubuntu on this machine, so the previous one I had, and sorry for those who are, you know, not particularly interested in Doug and Dai's technical adventures, feel free to skip this bit. But every time I update Ubuntu on this machine, as opposed to my previous one, which just worked with everything, which was the Lenovo ThinkPad X220, this Dell machine, because it's a bit newer, it's got newer features and specs and everything. Every time, what happens is the Wi-Fi breaks, but also the Ethernet breaks as well. Mm-hmm. Which is obviously problematic, because usually what you do is just plug in a cable and then find your fix. But it's actually easier to fix the Wi-Fi and also the external display. So Oliver Quinlan has actually just messaged me on Mastodon, on social.coop, saying, please do let me know if you have any fix. At the moment, I haven't got a fix for the Ethernet, but the Wi-Fi is working fine. And people listening to this might think, oh my goodness, why would you ever want to mess about with stuff which just breaks? But actually, it's such a learning experience about how you fix things. Like we said before, it makes you feel like your device is your own with all of its quirks and foibles. And yeah, the interesting thing about Ubuntu 17.04 is that there's an open version of Apple's AirPrint protocol, which means they just automatically discovers and configures local printers, which has been a real bugbear of mine, to the extent that I was sending almost all of my printing on my Linux machines, of which I've got three. I was sending it via Google Print. So sending it via the cloud to print to my network printer, which is insane. But now on 17.04, it just works absolutely fine.
Well, I'm going to annoy you. So I'm on 16.4 and I connected to my printer over the through the air on the network this week. and it worked fine using something, I can't remember what it was called. Really weird piece of software that runs in your browser. And it was kind of good. Didn't install. Mm-hmm. It was very odd. I don't remember what it was. I just did it, and it worked because I have, for the first time in 15 years, bought a printer, which is a very strange thing, because I've always worked in schools. Mm-hmm. There's always printing not far away. But anyway, I decided it was time that I could print stuff out right here. Anyway, so that's done.
Cool. So we're short of time tonight. Yes, we always say that we're going to be shorter than usual, but tonight, you know, it's now 10 o'clock at night after funnying on with different configurations of microphones, etc. I'm up tomorrow morning. I've got a meeting first thing with colleagues at Totra in New Zealand, and I need to go for a run before that. So plenty of stuff to get through, but we might have to pick and choose and bounce about a bit.
That's right. Because we couldn't find any other time in our schedules when we could meet.
Busy people. The first thing I want to say is that I've been messing about with GitHub again to host websites, and the particular one which you're happy to have a look at, I was messing about just making it last night, is my local. I mentioned last week that I'm now secretary of the local scout troop, and as the one with the most technical skills, I said that I would create a website. Now, when I did one for my local church, which I've mentioned before, I did it on WordPress because it was important that lots of people could access it and update it. Whereas with this one, it's almost like a magazine kind of one-stop shop. The only interaction that you'll really have, apart from downloading PDFs, is a contact to say, yes, I'd like to send my son or daughter, please can I have further details. So I said, well, I'll do it on GitHub because it's free hosting and it'll be super fast and more secure, etc. And it just reminded me just how, if you know what you're doing on GitHub, I didn't even use the command line or any GitHub software. I just used the GitHub website. And if you follow the instructions, if you type into your favorite search engine, GitHub Pages Help, it walks you through how to set up a website on GitHub. And as long as you follow the instructions, it couldn't be simpler. And really, it's a wonderful way of creating like a project website or a quick and easy, simple website. And this particular one is using Jekyll, which is a static site generator. And the wonderful thing for me is that once you've got it set up, you can do some, I've messed about with the configuration files more than I need to, but if the most basic version, you use Markdown, which for those who are listening who haven't come across it, is a really easy way of not having to write HTML, but being able to put links in and bullet points and all that kind of stuff in a much easier, more straightforward way. And it's lovely. So I enjoy doing that.
Good. Looks good. There's a little bit of an error. So I've got on mine anyway. So on your menu on the left-hand side where you've put notes.
Yeah, I know, at the bottom. Yeah.
But it looks nice. Well done. Mm-hmm. Well done, Mr. Belshaw.
Yeah, well, very easy. Good. So that's that. I wrote a blog post. So I mentioned I've been doing this work with Totra. And did I put this in last week? I don't think I did. Why your user community needs a code of conduct. I decided to write it straight on LinkedIn. And yeah, it's just talking about why it's a really important thing that a community has a code of conduct rather than just trying to make it implicit. Even if you haven't got an issue at the moment, you don't know what you don't know about who's being put off because of the way that your community interacts. So it's important to have a code of conduct, and I've put I've come up with a code of conduct for Totra. It's going to go out to the existing user community for feedback, and so I haven't shared it on here yet, but I have put in some guidelines in terms of the kinds of things that should go in there, and also where I've got my inspiration from. So there's like the Mozilla one and the Ubuntu one and the Citizen Code of Conduct, etc. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've just written a post in terms of guidance and had some good feedback on it.
Cool. I've liked your page on LinkedIn. That's the first LinkedIn activity I've had in a couple of years. What was I going to say? Why did you write straight into LinkedIn rather than onto your blog or whatever?
Yeah, well, I would usually do the posse model, like we've talked about before, where you publish on your own blog and then put elsewhere. But I don't know.
I just got taken by a moment.
For that particular one, I just wanted it to be one existing in one place.
Did you include that quote? I saw you put a quote on about code of conduct somewhere about the internet's, there's loads of haters or something. I don't know. It was good. I quite liked it when I read it.
Did you put it on? What was that?
I can't remember. You put it on Mastodon, the starting point for any code of conduct.
No? Oh, okay.
You don't remember. Okay, doesn't matter. It was funny though.
Oh, right. Yeah, there were, right. So, yeah, I can't remember. Did we talk about last week about the having an argumentation culture or interrupt culture or something?
Yeah, we did talk about the interrupt culture last week, but that wasn't the thing.
I'll see if I can find it. Yeah, I don't post that much on social co-op, so you can probably find it on there.
Cool. That's good. Good advice for a code of conduct.
Yes, there we go. So that's that. The other thing just to point out is next week I'm going to be in Barcelona and I'm going to be speaking at a conference called All Digital, which I think I mentioned. And the title of my presentation is Future Infrastructure, Future Skills, and Future Mindset. And, you know, I tend to present using similar kind of colors in my slides and similar kind of layout. And I thought, well, I really like the website for this All Digital conference. It's kind of got really bright colors with a gradient. And so I thought, well, I wonder if there's such a thing as being able to easily get Google slide themes, because that's not something I've really done before. I've just used the built-in ones or built my own. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I came across a website. I mean, they're not amazing, but I did come across one website just called freegooglesslidestemplates.com, which had one. If you go on the front page of that, it had this really nice going from pink to orange, which almost exactly matched this All Digital conference website. So I'm using that one, and it couldn't be easier. Like, you press view and then you open it, and then you just, like on a Google Doc, you press, you know, make a copy, and off you go. So it was great.
Excellent. I've just been working in Google Slides this evening, creating a diagram for, I have a meeting tomorrow, a digital strategy meeting with the leadership team, looking at the different phases that we're moving through. So I've just created this sort of layered stairs shape where the bottom layer is phase one, second layer is phase two, phase three, phase four for the next 3 years. So phase one was last year, so the next 3 years of where we're going, just to create an easy visualization with detail, some detail in it about what we're doing and why we're doing it, to get us all on the same page tomorrow, which has been quite an interesting process, but I haven't had enough time to spend on it, but that's going to be tomorrow morning.
I hope. Cool.
Good.
Okay, so should we dive into some of the stuff we've been talking about? Lots of this is from my newsletter, as ever. Some of it I get a chance to talk about at length, and in my newsletter, and some bits I don't. Was there anything which really kind of grabbed your attention on this list?
Let's go for it.
To get through all of it.
Let's go for Entropy Schlepper. I quite like this. By Dorian Taylor.
So Dorian Taylor is a guy who I've had some interactions with on Twitter, and I've followed for the last probably 4 years, I guess, because he interacts a lot with Carla Casilli, who I worked with at Mozilla. And he is a really interesting guy, and I've never really known what he does, because he always explains what he does in a really roundabout, random way. And he actually talks about that in the introduction to this interview. Now, I love this website, and I've mentioned it before. It's called Uses This, and it used to be called The Setup, but now it's just called Uses This. And it's this, they would always ask the same questions. Who are you and what do you do? What hardware do you use? What software do you use? And what would be your dream setup? And some of these interviews are really short because I think they're doing by email. And some of them are really long. And this one's a really long one. And that's because he's quite a philosophical guy. And he talks about schlepping entropy. I take the disorder I find in organizations and I do my best to clean it up. In that way, I'm more like a janitor than a designer, engineer, architect, strategist, management consultant, whatever. Right now, I'm particularly interested in the mess around cleaning up messes, meta mess, if you will. But the whole interview is really interesting in terms of like your approach to technology. He talks about like not being interested in like which browser he's using or which calendar, but like open standards, everything just working, using old technology, and like focusing on like the work. And it's just wonderful.
I think it's it is really enjoyable, isn't it? So I think a lot of this is to do with, I mean, a lot of technology, education technology or technology in general gets a bad name because people end up creating more work for people with technology rather than saving time. And what you don't really do is similar to any organization. You build new things that people have to do on top of the old things that they have to do, and you never take them away. And we've discussed that sort of thing before, that you must say, I want you to do this, therefore I'm going to take this away because this is more important. And we're going to, you know, shift and over time. And I think with technology, this is exactly what happens, is you're left with lots of things that people are doing which are of very little consequence. And one of the things I wanted to ask you actually about your Scouts website was, are you using analytics on it? Are you going to see how many people are actually using it and how useful it is?
Yeah, I will do. When I did have a Google Analytics kind of thing built into Jekyll, and I've just left it the default, whatever that is, at the moment. But yes, I will be doing that, yeah.
Yeah, so and it's an important thing, isn't it? So I've just had this guy at our place has set up photo of the week at the school, which is sort of front or on the sidebar of our homepage on our intranet. And you can click into it and then go through a gallery of all the photos with the one who's been awarded photo of the week included. And it's a really, really lovely idea, but it'll be interesting to see over time because he's had to learn the processes of setting this up each week and how to replace it and make sure the widgets connect to the right pages underneath.
Well, that's the thing. There's something about processes. Like, so for example, like I mentioned the church website earlier. My wife does the church newsletter. And the way that they share that on the website is a really fragile way of doing it. They basically replace a particular document with the same name on Dropbox all the time, which has this really long unwieldy link, but then it's on the church website. And like the process breaks all the time. I'm like, guys, surely we can do something better than this. But of course, the better process would involve not just updating something on their Dropbox, which is, you know, gets synced to their machine, but actually going into the WordPress site and logging in and doing all that kind of stuff. So there's no archive to the newsletter. And it reminded me, one of the newsletters I read on the way down on the train was Dan Hon. Dan's a really interesting guy. I've mentioned him on this podcast before. English guy, works in the US. And he writes these really long newsletters at a very sporadic kind of cadence. And you get one in the inbox and it's like yay long. And I've linked to it and he calls it Welcome to the Churn. And he talks about a specific situation where he's trying to do stuff with healthcare and making, you know, healthcare in the US just better and work more effectively and efficiently. And he's basically estimating how many people are involved in jobs that don't really need to exist. And the example he gives is, okay, so you're doing a new system and you say, right, well, it's going to all be digital. And then someone in the meeting says, well, it can't all be digital because people in rural, back of beyond are going to need to fax in their form. You say, well, no, we're going to launch the system in 2 years' time. So we give them plenty of notice and we give them training and we get rid of fax machines because it's going to be 2019 and we do everything digitally. And they're like, no, 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 no. And you try and argue the case and you lose. So you've now got like the person who hasn't got the digital skills, who is doing the fax machine, training the new person on how to use the fax machine instead of how to do the digital thing. And so you just end up like with this bloated mass of people who are using outdated technology. And his contention was that you know, there's going to come a time when that just all gets cut out. And what are we going to do about that mass of people? This isn't even robot stealing your job, Di. This is just, oh, look at all that cruft of outdated technology we've got. Now we've got people who can do this a lot faster, and now we need 2 people instead of 20, which I thought was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think these things are, as they streamline over time, and I mean, that is what technology is doing, is it's allowing less people to do more things. If you get your processes set up and you know your tech, I think that's an important point. Otherwise, everything just seems like it takes a long time. They have to get to grips with it, and it's, you know, people don't get on board.
Where should we go next? There's a few education related things in the, there was the TES article about the dangers of sweating the small stuff in the classroom. Quite a kind of short article by a head teacher, which definitely struck a chord with me. There was a blog post by Professor Martin Weller.
You mentioned it. Let's start educational stuff.
Let's do it. Okay.
Too many schools have lost sight of the problems they are trying to solve. What problems are they?
Just an update on last week's podcast. So last week I mentioned that my local school, King Edward the Sixth in Morpeth, has changed from kind of a polo shirt and a jumper uniform to a blazer and tie uniform. And I was bemoaning this fact. I found out via another parent this week, in between podcasts, that the reason for that was that the school went to a debating competition. And at the debating competition, so maybe year 11s, I think, they went to the debating competition and they came second out of 12 schools, which is very good. But apparently out of the 12 schools, they were the only ones wearing kind of a polo shirt and jumper combination. And they came back and basically petitioned the head to change the uniform.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Isn't that interesting that they go in there, standing out in their uniform as they are, they come second in the competition out of 12, which is no small feat. And still they don't feel that that's strong enough, a strong enough statement all in itself, you know, is that the uniform is irrelevant. And instead they revert to type, to the norm, to the consensus. It's quite an interesting thing. I know here, when we have our uniform for when we're in lessons, but wouldn't it make sense to have, is that we have alternative uniforms kind of thing? You have smarter dress, or you have smart casual that you have to go to the theatre in or to musical concerts and things like that. And that kind of thing, but you have different levels of dress. And that seemed to make sense to me, is that in your normal daily work.
Well, yeah, at your school, the parents can afford 5 uniforms, but that's not true.
I don't know. I don't think a blazer, you don't, yeah, blazers can be expensive, I think. But shirts and ties aren't expensive.
Yeah, no, you can get those from places that are cheap. But this particular article is interesting because it talks about arbitrary rules. And the way that I introduced this in my newsletter was talking about, you know, like when kids come home and do their homework, I know my son chews chewing gum sometimes, he'll have the music on, you know, he'll sit not bolt upright in his chair, but he'll maybe slouch over the table and whatever. And that seems to be how he works best. And he'll get up and move around and like I do, like when I'm working from home, I'll move around quite a lot and be different places with different types of activities. Mm-hmm. And so this head teacher, Jarlath O'Brien, who's director for schools at the Eden Academy, and he's got a book out, Better Behavior, A Guide for Teachers, is saying, like, we need to focus on what's important, like, rather than just being control freaks. So I was definitely behind that.
No, I think it is important. I still think, as I said with the uniform last week, there's a little thing about dealing with low-level behavior can help you with or help you avoid having to deal with more difficult issues by establishing calm and order, that sort of thing. But then I agree that spending time, if these things are disrupting learning all of the time, they get very tiresome. And I think also there's a real sense and sensibility about doing things well, and like people being able to understand intrinsically why things are set out the way that they are. And when you have things like wearing a tie and a stiff collar all day long, and you know, and uncomfortable shoes and things like that, you kind of realize that it's a bit stupid, and it's like, well, if people
exactly, and it's not that, you know, like
you know.
The reason that people often give is like preparing them for the workforce. But, mm-hmm. you know, as we've said before, like the majority of the workforce aren't wearing suits, really. I mean, maybe if they're going to into elite positions and CEO material, like from your school potentially, but the majority of kids from state schools aren't going to be like going, I'm stereotyping massively here, but like I haven't worn a tie since, well, I worn at my grandma's funeral, and that's about it, like for.
But that's kind of what I mean. Absolutely. That's what I was saying about, about is it King Edward the VI, is that they, you know, if you have a change of uniform, it doesn't have to be a big change, but, you know, when every day you're wearing comfortable, functional, practical clothing for the job, for the things that you're doing, and but then you have a, like a smarter version of your uniform that you can wear, well, that's just sensible. That's what we all have. That's what life is, in a way. I mean, even though you don't necessarily wear a tie, you'll have smarter clothes than you do, and sort of downtime clothes and clothes you wear out with your children and different things like that. And and I think it's that thing about sense and sensibility. If people can see why things are being done, it just makes a lot of sense. So he talks about running.
Well, that's what this article's getting at. It gives a specific example of a kid crossing their legs on the chair. Yeah, so sitting without any feet on the floor.
Yeah.
And the school rule was, you know, four legs of the chair on the ground and two legs of the child on the floor. And that was to stop swinging on the chair, I think, or so, or whatever. And they were losing the point of what was going on there. Now, an interesting thing's happened to me today, or to where we live, in that we've had some of those dodgy people come around the door, you know, selling you stuff, but really casing the joint. And lo and behold, after the second one came around, our next door neighbor had the window cleaning money nicked out of their porch. Yeah.
Okay.
So everyone's reaction to that is, oh my goodness, we're going to get CCTV. We're going to lock everything down. I'm going to get a fence. I'm going to do this. I'm like, well, that would be one response to that, which would be, you know, bolting the door after the, you know, locking the door after the horse is bolted. But really, it's kind of having a proportionate response. And I think as a society, we need to deal better with this. It's the same with terrorism as well. I got on the tube, obviously, between the two trains I had to get today. And as I went down to get the tube, I was, you know, in my mind was the recent kind of terror attack in London and in Spain and stuff as well, which is ridiculous, you know, given the likelihood of these things happening. And yet we seem to overreact and think that overreacting makes things better rather than playing into people's hands, etc. So I think anywhere from schools to our homes to society, we need to learn how to have a proportionate response to what's actually happening in front of us.
I think that's right, and I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it? At what point is enough cases of problems with a particular issue, incidents, does that warrant? So we have 1,112 pupils at our school. How many in an academic year, how many cases warrant a change in how we do things rather than those individual cases being addressed on their merit or whatever, you know, on their situation? And I think it's really important, and interestingly, this article links to the entropy article, really, I think, in that what happens is that with behavioural policies and codes of conduct for children and teachers, you end up with lots of dead weight, just things that can be shaved off that are really having no effect, and yet people are spending their time and energy dealing with them. A good example of this, actually, is that a friend of mine's just moved schools down to a school in Cheltenham. And she has to register 66 people in her boarding house three times a day, and then every child in every lesson of her school day. And we don't do that. And it's just like, you multiply that by the number of teachers in the school, the number of lessons per day through the year. And that's a lot of time and energy that's spent doing that, and to what cause?
You were talking about entering passwords and like thinking like what is actually the problem here. There has to be a point, like you're never going to get a situation where nothing bad ever happens in any given situation. You just have to try and minimize that wherever possible and have a process for when things do go wrong.
And be vigilant.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing I've been messing about with this week is musician, which might seem a bit random, but it's in the kind of vein of Duolingo and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was recommended. So I've got this, I've started playing the guitar a bit more. Like I thought, well, I should, by the time I'm 40, I should be able to play something on the guitar. It's been sitting there for long enough. So I brought it inside the house and I was using, I think the most popular guitar tuning app, which is called Guitar Tuner, but with an A, like the fish.
Excellent.
And so I was using that to tune it and playing chords and stuff, which is nice. It's got a little game, you know, you can play your major chords and see how many you can do in a short amount of time. It's a bit gamified. And it was linked to another app that they've got called Musician. And so I gave it a try, and it was actually really nice. It keeps trying to upsell you, but what it does, Di, is, have you tried it? Have you tried
Musician
before?
No, it's new to me.
So it's a bit Duolingo-like, and it kind of takes you along and shows you which fingers to play and all that kind of stuff. And it can give you instant feedback because it's listening to the chords and all that kind of stuff. And it automatically changes how fast the music goes depending on how confidently you're playing it.
Clever.
And my son is not enthusiastic about playing the piano at the moment, even though his piano teacher is like super cool and a really nice guy and doing all the best he possibly can with him. But he seemed to like really be into doing using this app. And, you know, he voluntarily got it out on his phone and started using it this morning. And I think it's because you're getting instant feedback as opposed to, like, with the best one in the world, when he's practicing, I can't be sitting next to him giving him feedback all the time, whereas this app is giving him just constant feedback. And I can't help but think that, you know, these things aren't going to replace teachers, but they're just going to augment them, you know, in the same way that, you know, they can give that kind of automatic feedback. You know, they can't do the human level feedback, but they can do their automated feedback at a fairly basic level, which I think is quite valuable.
But I think there's a lot to be said for that. I use Duolingo a lot this summer for my French. So I used to go to France a lot, but I've never been able to speak it because I just went with English people and didn't really speak much. But I did O-level French back in the day.
Hmm.
But I've always been pretty dreadful at it, so I don't speak French to anyone who speaks French in schools, if you know what I mean. And there's always a couple of French people hanging around. Anyway. So I used Duolingo over the summer. When I was on holiday in France, I spoke a lot of French to French people for a lot of the time. And indeed, they were wonderfully sympathetic and patient. But we managed to discuss everything under the sun, so like politics and driving and you know, all this, that, and the other. And so it was quite good. And Duolingo was a big help in that. It gave me a lot of confidence. I used it regularly quite a lot. Before I went, so that I was, it's because I knew I'd be on my own out there and not in touristy places, and yeah, it was really cool, it was the first time I've ever got anywhere close to feeling like I know a language, if you know what I mean, and I can speak it and participate in somebody else's conversation with it, so yeah, I'm really, and well done Duolingo. So there is something in that, so I had that motivation to improve my French, and
gamification when it's done well, I think, yeah, does a good job. Going back to the kind of proportionate response kind of riff that we were on, the next kind of link in here is called Anatomy of a Moral Panic. I don't know if you saw this.
No, I haven't seen this. What is it?
So this is a Channel 4 documentary, which or a news segment, should I say, and their headline was Potentially Deadly Bomb Ingredients Are Frequently Bought Together on Amazon.
Okay. Scary.
So I'll just read this bit. It says, the piece claims that users searching for a common chemical compound used in food production are offered the ingredients to produce explosive black powder on Amazon's website, and that steel ball bearings often used as shrapnel are also promoted on the page, in some cases as items that other customers also bought. And it continues and says, basically,
frequently bought together these three items.
Yeah, it's basically like, if you go to Amazon's page to order a half kilo bag of potassium nitrate, then you'll see suggested items that include sulfur and charcoal, the other two ingredients of gunpowder. And it says in brackets, unlike Channel 4, I am comfortable revealing the secrets of this 1,000-year-old technology. and this goes through and it says, like, if you look at it, right, what it is, it's a hobbyist community of people who mill their own black powder at home safely and legally for use in fireworks, model rockets, antique firearms, or to blow up the occasional stump. So it's massive sensationalism. And this person is just calling them out, saying, like, what are Channel 4 doing? Why are you being so sensationalist? They're not recommending bomb ingredients. They're just, like, producing stuff for hobbyist market. Like, this is not anything amazing at all. It's basically old media not really understanding how the internet works again.
And speaking of that, actually, you reminded me of Channel 4 documentaries. There was a Storyville. Do you know Storyville on BBC? You ever seen those?
I don't think I've seen
that. There's lots of episodes about different things, kind of thing. It's like a new panorama of sorts. And it tells these stories. One of them is about Silk Road, drugs, death, and the dark web. I was just looking for it now because you mentioned it, and it's actually...
Is it on the iPlayer?
It's not. It says, sorry, this episode is currently not available, which I watched it in the summer. It was on the 21st.
I'm sure you'll be able to find it on
I'm sure you could find it. It's on the 21st of August, 2017. It's an hour and a half, but it was fascinating about how Silk Road came about. And as a sort of...
Well, if you put the link on, I'll see if I can find a version on YouTube or whatever.
Yeah, cool.
Just to say this idle words thing finishes, so obviously when you get automatic recommendations on Amazon, etc., that's machine learning in some sense. It's an algorithm. And at the end, just to quote, it says, the real story of machine learning is not how it promotes homemade bomb making, but it's being deployed at scale with minimal ethical oversight in the service of a business model that relies entirely on psychological manipulation and mass surveillance. The capacity to manipulate people at scale is being sold to the highest bidder and has infected every aspect of civic life, including democratic elections and journalism. End of quote.
Wow, heavy words.
Awful stuff. Yes.
That's it's quite interesting. I was talking just yesterday to whatever class. Obviously, I repeat myself every year, so probably have said this on time before. But I think we've discussed before the idea that these machine learning kind of algorithms, recommendation engines kind of thing, will homogenize people towards the same things. It's quite interesting. But there we go.
No, I think that's true. I think that's true.
That's inevitable. There's no sort of serendipity to it.
Well, the thing I find really interesting is that, so I still am following all the people that I was following on Twitter. And, you know, I don't spend, apart from putting my blog post on Twitter and then checking it every so often to see if I've got any mentions or DMs, I'm not on there all the time. I used to have like TweetDeck running all of the time. Mm. And so I was reading stuff constantly. And you think you're, keeping up to date with things. Well, one app that I use is called Nuzzle, which we've mentioned on here before. Do you use Nuzzle, Dave?
Yes, I do. And I know some others do it. I know Michelle Goulin, is it? Is that his name? Miguel.
Miguel Goulin? Yeah.
That's it. He uses it for a newsletter. So he produces a newsletter through Nuzzle.
Well, so the way that Nuzzle works, you can configure it different ways. But basically, if a few people in your network share an article, then it bubbles up in kind of an algorithmic way. What I found on there, so I'm looking for lots of different sources of things to read, newsletters that arrive in my inbox. I use Nuzzle, I use Feedly, I use just following stuff I happen to be interested in and searching for. And I share those in blog posts and on Thought Shrapnel and also on Thought Shrapnel Live, which is a Telegram channel where I post things that I find often. And what I find is, it's the same sources that I'm sharing when I take things from Nuzzle, even though you'd think that the people I'm following on Twitter would be reasonably diverse. So, yeah, I think we are getting normed in some kind of way.
All right. Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? It does scare me, the whole norming thing, actually. I think, so if I read the last paragraph of this Idle Words thing, The Anatomy of Moral Panic, it says, together with climate change, this algorithmic takeover of the public sphere is the biggest news story of the early 21st century. We desperately need journalists to cover it. But as they grow more dependent on online publishing for their professional survival, their capacity to do this kind of reporting will disappear, if it has not disappeared already.
Hmm.
Which is pertinent, I think.
The private takeover of the public sphere isn't just online, it's offline as well. So I was reading something in The Guardian today, which maybe I'll have a proper read of and we can talk about next week. But, London is the hotbed in terms of the whole world of public, private, weird kind of spaces where it's actually, you're allowed to be there as a member of the public, but, you know, it's privately owned and, this, you know, you've got no rights, basically. They can kick you off any time. Mm-hmm. And there's more and more developments which are, you know, owning, as people are trying to invest in cities, they're, you know, they want to own the land as well. So increasingly, public land is being sold off to public-private partnerships. And yeah, so we're in a weird space where both our digital spaces and our physical spaces are increasingly privatized.
Yes, I mean, that is a concern. And as you know, the physical world is becoming that way at the same time as the virtual world is. So, even our needs and tastes. So it's interesting how human tastes can be defined and sort of thing. But anyway, let's move on. I'm not going to say that.
Yeah, there's a nice segue actually into, I mentioned Martin Weller's post just before. So he's written one called "When This Is All Over, We Still Have to Clear Up." I love Martin's writing. He's fantastic because he's an academic, so he's, you know, really like ready stuff and knows what he's talking about. But also because he's blogged for, you know, longer than I have, I think, he writes in a really engaging way as well. So he talks about the unenlightenment in other posts. But he says, you know, there's been an impact over the last few years on social cohesion, family cohesion. There's a wonderful line here where he says, where is it? He talks about, like, you know, everyone does different things at the weekend. You come and work together on a Monday. Everyone does different things at the weekend. You talk about what you did at the weekend. Everyone goes, oh, well, that's not my cup of tea. You know, you'd never catch me doing that or whatever. But everyone's getting on with each other. And he says, you don't go on a Nazi rally at the weekend and then come into work on Monday like it was an outing to the mall. And you don't say you support someone who backs that rally, then move on to talking about the football. Yeah, there are no gentle comedies waiting to be made of this era, which portray family members initially arguing bitterly, but coming to understand that each side has a point. When one side wants to deny you or your friend's right to existence, there is no common middle ground. End of quote.
Yeah, which is pertinent when you look at the German election that happened this week, and the is it the AfD? I think the right, the far right party gained 15% of the votes or something.
Yep.
Something quite worrying.
Yeah, and then the leader of that party quit as soon as she was elected. So, yeah, crazy.
Great.
But he there's five bullet points in here about some of the areas that we as educators will need to address.
Mm-hmm. I'll do the first one. Educating network-savvy students, dealing with fake news, engaging in meaningful debates, understanding the role of tech companies, data privacy, and the social impact of all of this will be cross-cutting. Computer science degrees can't operate now without understanding how algorithms shape power, and social scientists can't work without appreciating how platforms shape identity. Pick a subject, and the social element of the network needs to be part of the curriculum.
Yeah. Digital scholarship. I've been updating my digital scholarship talk for someone recently, thinking about what has changed since I wrote the book in 2011. Then it was a case of, hey, you should try using this stuff. It could be interesting for education. Now it's more a case of, we have a duty to use this stuff to help shape its future. That's a very different context for an academic.
Huge. And that is where I am, I think, with the digital strategy in my school, I think. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Next one, public engagement. How do academics and universities help shape the public discourse and politics so that facts, truth, knowledge, experts, and research are no longer dismissed as irrelevant?
Yeah, I can't believe that. I mean, if you just look at the last few years, since even just before Brexit and Trump and stuff, it seems like all of a sudden it's now okay to like be a flat earther, to not have to have any facts to back up your opinions. All this, it's crazy world that we live in. It's quite worrying. In fact, I put it.
Go on.
I did put something on Telegram just now while I was on the train about why we should what different strategies we can use to make sure that when somebody comes at us without facts, what we can do. And the six things they talk about is like keep emotions out of the exchange, discuss, don't attack. listen carefully, show respect, acknowledge you understand why someone might hold that opinion, and try to show how changing facts does not necessarily mean changing worldviews. Mm-hmm. But it's a really world. I mean, it's never been the case that you just point to a fact and someone says, "Oh, well, now I would change my whole worldview." But people at least respected facts as being a valuable thing to point to, whereas now it doesn't seem to be so much the case.
But I think it's how these things dilute their way down into non-academic worlds, sort of thing. So it's like the principle of what is true, what is a truth, what is a fact, and all of that thing. People undermine it so easily these days, and they have such little respect for it. And I think this is a lot to do with education needs to have a knowledge base, and that as well as the skills that are required, and they need to go together. You can't come from one angle or the other. I think you need a really solid platform of knowledge, and then your thinking is going to improve around that. And I think it's an important thing to emphasize that the curriculum is anyone who can master the school curriculum as it's laid out is doing a good job. They're going to be a well educated person, I think, and I still think that's the case. I'm a bit of a fan of the school curriculum, as we discussed before, and how it's just an explanation of the world and how we live in it, kind of thing. And I think if you started from scratch again, you'd probably end up with something that looks pretty much like the school curriculum as it is. I don't know.
You reckon?
I think so. I think there are sort of tweaks and things that I would do differently. Going back to the first bullet point, actually, in here, the educating network savvy students, I think there's some work needs to be done in it with that. I think the curriculum doesn't reflect it. I think digital media decoding is really, really important, which is a phrase I use. No one else has ever used it, so please don't use it anywhere else. People just think you're insane. But the idea that you understand that everything that you see has been processed by a computer and therefore might not be what it is purporting to be, and that will have an influence on your likes and tastes and identity, as Martin points out in whichever point he made that. Next one is yours.
Okay, it's building platforms and communities. Interdisciplinary work involving tech experts, psychologists, designers, social scientists, etc., must help inform the next wave of platforms, so they facilitate the sort of discussion and community we once hoped for on the open web. There was an interesting thing from which I was going to discuss next week, but I'll mention now. I'll not put the link in, but we'll talk about it in a bit more detail next week. But Signal, who we use to communicate, Di, and I think for both of us, it's replaced our default messaging app. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So Signal, like, it's kind of a social network-y kind of thing, like, needs to have a social graph. And the thing that they talk about in their most recent post is the need for contact discovery. Like, you need to know if other people are using Signal as well, rather than just talk about it in person. But they want to do that in a way which respects people's privacy and doesn't go through a central server. So they talk in very technical detail about how they've managed to do that, which is quite exciting. But that kind of stuff just gets bypassed by companies who want to get as many users as possible and then do an IPO and get shareholders and cash out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we do need different ways of funding things, and also getting all the people he mentions in there, like psychologists and designers and social scientists, etc., thinking about how we want networks. And that's why I guess I've switched from mainly interacting on Twitter to mainly interacting on a decentralized network like Mastodon.
Fair enough. I think it's the big building platforms and communities. It seems interdisciplinary work involving tech experts, psychologists, designers, social scientists, etc., must help inform the next wave of platforms. I don't think you can dictate that. I don't think, you know, these things just happen, don't they? So so that kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of explicit engagement by those different bodies. It's the sort of thing that happens over time with platform after platform after platform as they get refined and people find new ways of doing it, and they're possibly always driven, as you mentioned, by a sort of profit motive, going to IPO and cashing out and being successful in that way, and then looking back and realizing they want to be in a startup again and not work in a big firm, and never appreciating that it's a catch 22, isn't it, becoming a bigger and bigger company but maintaining your small size, which is where you're happy working, kind of thing. I don't know. Difficult thing to say.
Yeah, no, definitely.
The last one says policy. It's short and sweet. Policy, helping shape policy that makes democracy functional again. I think that's true. I think everyone's looking forward to that.
I think that one of the problems we've got is that a lot of our politicians don't really understand, like, the internet 1.0, never mind like anything that's happened since then.
I think that's right. And I think they'd also, I mean, politicians seem to me to be getting very, very distorted from what one imagines to be some good intentions as they start out in their career or in that part of their career. And they're getting very far away from it. And it just seems that you can't actually assume power through election and do a good job. It's a little bit of that going on because
money and power and corruption.
Exactly. So if you get into government, you're not going to take on was it GAFA, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon. Just not going to take them on. And if America don't do it and the EU doesn't do it, they're the two biggest. Without a collaboration between them, but if they collaborate, you're in this big sort of Star Wars federation world of the empire kind of thing.
We kind of just touched on there about different types of networks, and I just remembered that I read a really good post yesterday by a guy called Sean Tilley, who I follow on Social Co-op, and he wrote a quick guide to the free network. Now, I love blog posts like this, ones which are written by people who really know their stuff and explain things very clearly with diagrams so that people who kind of know what's going on get a much clearer view and can explain it themselves better. And in this, I'll not go into too much detail, but in this post, he talks about the difference between the Federation and the Fediverse, which is not Star Wars. It's talking about different types of decentralized social networks. He talks about different protocols and different ways of federating different instances, etc. And it sounds quite technical, but actually it's really interesting in terms of different networks and their approach to doing different things and what they're planning to do next, and how in the kind of next few years, there's a protocol called ActivityPub, which is now being adopted by lots of different versions of these different social networks like Mastodon and GNU Social and Friendica and Diaspora and Nextcloud, and how in time, these distinct supernetworks will likely fold into one federated supernetwork containing everybody, maximizing interoperability between 9 different systems, possibly more. Though such a scenario is still a long way off, it's entirely possible that we might see all of the major projects within this space interconnect with one another. So, it's a well-written post. And if you're new to all this and you don't know what's out there compared to, the usual Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc., then do have a look, because there's all cool people doing really edgy stuff. I was talking to Thomas Steele Maley. Hi, Thomas, if you're listening. He's doing some interesting work split between Maine and Dubai at the moment with GEM schools. And I was explaining to him how I try and push myself to not get comfortable in the technology I'm using and in the spaces that I'm at. Because what tends to happen is you think, oh, well, Twitter's where all of the interesting stuff's happening, for example. And of course, that was true, 5-10 years ago. But I don't think that's necessarily true now. There's lots of really cool things happening. But in terms of people who are really pushing the edges, that's happening elsewhere. And it's trying to find out where those spaces are that really interests me.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because, and the whole cooperative principle of a method of working is based on this, I think. So you have these 8 distinct platforms you just in this post. And if they can come together but still maintain that identity that brought their users to them, that would be a really, really powerful thing. So it's like the opposite of what we were just saying about, you know, getting bigger and bigger companies, how you maintain your involvement, your networking, without it being part of a big shareholder IPO event where you're making celebrity businessmen and women, essentially, who have great power, because they start controlling their networks, and then their intentions are distorted by profit motives. And you know, this sort of cooperative thing where people come together from their disparate groups and join hands, if you like, without actually moving into each other's spaces, kind of thing. Does that make sense? But without taking ownership, so they don't become one big company to rule them all. They're just connected instances which can have a unified voice through their users' wishes, if you know what I mean. It would be quite powerful, really.
No, I think so. And I think that especially given, I think the US government have announced, is it today or yesterday, that from October the 14th, the stuff we've talked about before in terms of social media and checking people's social media feeds, etc., is going to be a lot more draconian than we thought.
Mm-hmm. Shock horror.
Which is going to be interesting. So I think people will be turning to more private spaces to share things, you know. There's different forms of privacy, etc. There's, you know, we share things, die on Slack and on Signal, on Telegram and various places. And I think that whereas before it was like, oh, the internet and everyone's going to come together and it's all going to be wonderful, we've turned out that we've realized that actually when you get all of humanity on there, you get all of the, like, you get all of humanity. So you get all of the good and bad things. So people will possibly like splinter off into different groups again. And we could call that tribalism, or we could just call it affinity-based interest groups. But we'll see what happens.
While you're just touching on the draconian measures that people are taking towards our data, I'm just going to look for something. There's a gentleman coming into the UK who was arrested because he wouldn't unlock his digital devices.
Is this the guy from Cage?
I don't know where he's from.
It's a human rights organization. There was an article on The Intercept about it.
You know, I just thought it was a big deal. I didn't realize that would ever happen in the UK, but there it is. Londoner jailed after refusing to
unlock his mobile phone. It was under Section 7 of the Terrorism Act, I think.
Well, that's in 2016.
Yes, but his court has only just gone through the High Court. Okay. Case has only just gone through the High Court.
Yep. So the penalty for not handing over your password on demand to the state is something not very good.
It's prison, but he's had a suspended sentence, I think, and had to pay costs. Now, apparently, there was some ambiguity as to whether he told the officials that he was representing a client and therefore it was confidential information relating to a case. Mm-hmm. And if he had said that, then whether he would have been let off. But it sounds like they were just trying to make excuses, and actually it was a test case for using Section 7 of the Terrorism Act for something which wasn't a terrorism-related activity, but trying to force someone to give up their passwords.
Yeah. Well, he's also received firearm sentences for antique guns, this guy. I don't know if that's the one someone was talking to me about today.
They drag the whole thing in, don't they?
Difficult to decipher. There it is. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's have this. Let's have text push to teach coding isn't about kids' success. It's about cutting wages.
I think we knew this already, didn't we?
I think we did. Make us more coders so we don't have to pay the coders who are making us money more money.
I did see that the US government has plowed $200 million into, you know, computer science, I think. Now, as I commented on this article in whatever, wherever I shared it, I can't remember. I think I shared on Telegram. Like, people want one or the other, whereas actually it's this awkward, muddy thing in the middle. We do need to teach kids how to code, don't we? Right?
We do.
And we do need to teach, we need to teach some of them to be amazing coders and programmers, but we need to teach all of them how to think algorithmically. I mean, I wrote a blog post for DML Central back in 2013 or something about the importance of learning to code.
This is an interesting thing about computer science becoming a core subject, and how that move's been made at a state level, and IT is no longer, there are no qualifications, or there might be one or two that have been made quickly this summer, qualifications that you can teach in a school anymore. And it's all computer science based, but I completely subscribe to what you say as a computer science teacher, that not all children need to learn how to program computers. All children, however, as we discussed earlier in this podcast prior to this article, is should understand what computers can do and how they affect society.
Yeah, and the problem is that the thing which is holding them back from doing that is the lack of knowledge of adults, mainly, I would say. In general, in society, there's a wonderful paragraph of this.
Lack of knowledge of adults, did you say?
Yeah. So you know, if you go to an average adult as a kid who's interested in how Facebook works, mm-hmm. or how like the network effects work on Twitter, or how something really simple like a web page works, or whatever, you go to like. If the average kid goes to their parent and asks them that, they've got no idea.
Yeah, that's the first thing.
Yeah.
So therefore, they can't be passed down. That information can't be passed from one to another. And one of the things that I'm always struck by the people I teach is that they're often swept away, seduced by the shine, by the greatest tech thing. And it's only as they become sixth form students, or my computer science sixth formers, over their two-year course, learn that it ain't all about the shiny, and to sort of scrutinize what a computer is doing. And as you learn, and when you're learning to program, you do learn that. You learn that, okay, I understand now that these things are just at the control of one person or a team of people making certain decisions.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful paragraph in this article, this Guardian article about coding and education. It says, quote, "Silicon Valley is not a uniquely benevolent force, nor a uniquely malevolent one. Rather, it's something more ordinary, a collection of capitalist firms committed to the pursuit of profit. And as every capitalist knows, markets are figments of politics. They are not naturally occurring phenomena, but elaborately crafted contraptions, sustained and structured by the state, which is why shaping public policy is so important. If tech works tirelessly to tilt markets in its favor, it's hardly alone. What distinguishes it is the amount of money it has at its disposal. What distinguishes it is the amount of money it has at its disposal, so to do." End of quote.
It's true. I used to mention this before. Yeah, mentioned people who wake up in the middle of the night with an idea and they've got enough money to make that idea become something.
Yes, exactly.
And these seem to be the good ideas, more or less, and they're not necessarily so.
Yep.
Interesting article. Good.
It is. It's a good. There's so many good articles in the Guardian at the moment, I have to say.
They are working on doing good journalism, aren't they? I think that.
They are, yeah. And, you know, I think we've said before, but we both support them through the digital edition, don't we? So.
I do. I was having
an
interesting conversation the other day. We were talking about, with one of my pupils, talking about cars, self-driving cars, and they were saying. We were looking at what the ethical, moral kind of things are about self-driving cars. I'm a big fan of the idea that in the lifetime of the children I am teaching, people will be banned from driving vehicles on the road because computers will be so much better at it. And which is where our conversation began. And he said, it's really not fair how people expect computers to be able to make decisions that human beings can't. So computers are subject to tests that human beings are not subject to when they're learning to drive. I thought that was quite funny.
I think that's a fair point, actually.
Yeah. It's sort of, I mean, and why should they be, to be fair?
And the level of objectivity. Yeah.
The level of objectivity and reaction within a given situation of shall I kill this one person or these three people, if that's the choice on her hand, where do you go, kind of thing. And
there's some stuff which we're not going to get to here, which is about the EU paying for a report that concluded piracy isn't harmful and then tried to hide the findings.
Oh my God, that's too interesting. It's such a fantastic report. article. It's like,
no, Di, I want to go to sleep. Yeah, okay. It's 11 o'clock.
All right, fair enough.
Cory Doctorow has been instrumental in the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who I support, like removing themselves from the World Wide Web Consortium, which is a huge deal over DRM being part of the HTML protocol. There's a wonderful, wonderful article by an explorer about the power of silence in the smartphone age. So it's just some wonderful writing and quote. And I might even buy his book, which was the reason for the article. So if you ever, there's so many articles criticizing Facebook, but if you need a nice summary or the bullet point list of why they're so evil, there's a wonderful one there called What Facebook is Thinking. There's a video on kotka.org with some interest. There's two videos. There's the first one of this grumpy old man getting some special glasses, which allow him to see colors for the first time, and just his reaction, which is unbelievable and brought tears to my eyes. And then the science behind it, which is extremely interesting. And then the last one is, you've heard of holocracy before, which is where you don't have managers. Mm-hmm. This one's called sociocracy, which is a bit more of a sustainable, doable version of that, which actually has some wonderful ways of introducing decision-making within your organization, which isn't extremely hierarchical and top-down. So that's that.
Cool. Good stuff. What are you up to this week?
So I'm in Brighton. I'm working with Totra Wednesday, Thursday, Friday this week. I've got the kickoff meetings for this community migration project that I'm leading. And I'm back home. And then next week, it's a We Are Open co-op day on Monday. And I'm flying to Barcelona on Tuesday.
Excellent. Busy times.
How about you?
I'm doing, I can't remember, teaching. I just teach all of the time. I've just done Field Weekend. We've finished off a website over the weekend with the Digital Leaders, doing a website of tech advice for pupils by pupils, which I'm going to publish tomorrow. I'm hoping it will have a warm reception and get used, being the most important thing, if it's useful to people. Doing digital strategy stuff for this week, looking at communications apps. I think we talked about this last week. So I'm going to start looking at Microsoft Teams as a possible way of doing that we already pay for, rather than having to acquire an external service like Slack. And I know that Microsoft are looking at going that way to replace Skype, and Skype's on the way out, and they want a more Slack-like
platform.
So maybe Teams will work for that. I'm not really happy about using that, but we have to do what we have to do. And certainly have a look at it and put it, test it in anger a little bit. Stuff like that.
Great. Okay, well, thank you everyone for listening. This has been Tide 88 with me in Brighton and Di in
Oundle, no less. Have a good Oundle, week.
Near Peterborough. If you don't know where either of those two places are because you live somewhere in the far reaches of the earth, do look them up. And do say hello, give us a shout, and thank you for subscribing to this podcast, and we'll talk to you next time. Cheers, Di.
At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.